IBA Global Insight presents President Trump and Executive Power. In this podcast, John Yoo, former Deputy Assistant U.S. Attorney General in the George W. Bush administration, says that President Trump's controversial use of executive orders goes too far and is damaging his presidency. Speaking exclusively to the IBA's U.S. correspondent, Michael Goldhaber, Yoo also considers the new president's hostility towards the judiciary and draws comparisons with previous presidents, including Andrew Jackson and Richard Nixon. John Yoo is best known for authoring the so-called torture memos, which provided the legal basis for detention and enhanced interrogation policies under President Bush. We begin with South Korean-born Yoo sharing his very personal interest in the power of executive orders and the travel ban.
My interest in presidential power really came about because my family came to the United States in the mid-60s and from Korea, and it was always, I was always quite conscious of the Korean War and the U.S. intervention in 1950 that prevented Korea from, South Korea at least, from becoming a communist country, and seeing the misery of people who live in North Korea right now makes me especially conscious of, to me anyway, the benefits of executive power, because the Korean War, the constitutionality of the Korean War is really one of the great issues amongst constitutional lawyers who study war powers. And I've always thought, well, if President Harry Truman hadn't taken decisive action and acted quickly, if he had thought it was important to wait and ask Congress for permission for a declaration of war, I could well be living in North Korea right now.
And yet you've condemned President Trump for executive power run amok. So why is that?
Well, I think condemn is a little strong, given that he's only been in office 3 weeks. I was trying to raise something I hope was more cautionary, that he's gone too far and that it's harming his presidency. But that he should, if he could come to a better conception of the purpose of the office and the nature of executive power, it would, I hope, stabilize his administration.
Yoo assesses whether the executive orders on the Mexico wall and the travel ban go beyond the president's powers and the constitutional difficulties.
But to give some examples of things that worried me, for example, he said that he was going to build the wall along the Mexico-U.S. border and then charge Mexico for it by imposing a trade tariff or a tax of some kind on financial transfers to Mexico from the United States. Yeah, I think that's under the Constitution, outside the power of the president.
And the most controversial order, the travel ban, as it's more neutrally known, you think also goes too far?
Yeah, I thought parts of it do, parts of it don't. You look at the statute that's involved, the Immigration and Naturalization Act. There's two provisions that conflict. There's one that says the president has the authority to block entry of any, what the statute quotes as, class of aliens that's defined by the president. That would seem to support the legality of the order. But then the Immigration Naturalization Act also has a fairly broad provision saying that the immigration laws cannot be used to discriminate based on national origin. So both of those provisions seem to go in different directions on the order. But the thing that worries me, I would say the statutory conflict would come out on the side of the president there. But then I think there's a constitutional difficulty that the president, in the face of the executive order, doesn't talk about religion. But there have been leaks and close aides, and even the president said on the campaign trail before he took office that he was interested in banning Muslims from entering the United States. I think that would raise serious problems under the First Amendment, both the free exercise right of religion and also the prohibition on the establishment of religion. The problem, and that's what the courts in the U.S. are wrestling with, is how far are judges allowed to look behind the face of the order and question the motive of the president behind it, which is something courts generally are reluctant to do.
The discussion moves on to whether banning immigration is effective counterterrorism policy and other immigration issues.
It's not only you, it's also people like Dick Cheney and Michael Haley, who were very senior in the Bush administration and associated with some of its most controversial policies, who seem to be appalled by this executive order. So perhaps it also is counterproductive as a matter of terrorism policy, and perhaps also outside the mainstream of American values.
I would, you know, break it out into two different points there. One is, does it just make sense as a counterterrorism policy to ban immigration from these countries? And I don't think it is, and I think a lot of counterterrorism experts would agree. Also, it's too easy to get around. I mean, if you're ISIS or Al Qaeda and you want to slip operatives into the United States under this policy, you just pick someone who's got a passport from one of the other countries that's not on these seven. I think the better thing to do is to try to engage in close scrutiny of people coming from countries where you're worried about terrorist infiltration and the flow of people coming, rather than trying to just block off whole countries. It's just too easy to avoid, and actually prevents the United States from benefiting from cooperation from more moderate people from those countries who might help us identify and track down people trying to get into the country. You know, in terms of the broader immigration policy, until 1965, we did used to have quotas for specific countries, and it weighted in favor of Western European countries and basically cut off immigration from other parts of the world. And I think we decided to do away with that as a country in 1965. And I wouldn't like us to go back to that. There's lots of things to talk about in terms of what the best way to allocate immigration slots, but I don't think national quotas is what we want to return to.
You consider the parallels between Trump and previous presidents.
I'd like to pick out the two presidents that may resemble Trump the most, Andrew Jackson and Richard Nixon.
Jackson's presidency is almost defined by his conflict with the courts, with the Supreme Court in particular, and with Chief Justice John Marshall, but also with his broader claim that the courts should have a final say, whether the federal courts have the final say in the interpretation of the Constitution. And this goes to your point, Michael, about the parallels, or why at least Trump thinks he's Jacksonian. Jackson kind of represented a revolt against what he thought of as the Northeastern elites in Boston, New York, and Washington, and the courts. And he thought he stood, and he really was sort of the first president to portray himself as, you know, a small D Democrat, someone who represented the people. The famous quote from Jackson is, "Well, Chief Justice Marshall has rendered his opinion, now let him execute it," which has always been taken for the idea ever since that that the president can refuse to enforce a judicial decision if he has a different view of the Constitution. I think Jackson is much more thoughtful than Trump about his attitude towards the courts, but it does have the same level of hostility and doubt about the legitimacy of judicial review.
What are the lessons for today? Doesn't it show the limits of judicial control in the face of a president who can plausibly claim or more or less plausibly claim, you know, a popular mandate?
This goes back to these fundamental questions we have in our constitutional system in the United States about how far does judicial review really run when, as Alexander Hamilton said, the judiciary doesn't have force or will behind it. It only has judgment. And by that he meant ultimately the courts don't control the purse. They don't control the sword. They can only persuade ultimately the other branches and the American people to agree and to carry out what they want. Earlier in our history, periods with people like Jackson or Thomas Jefferson even challenged the courts and sometimes suggested, as Jackson did, that they would not obey a Supreme Court opinion they disagreed with. Abraham Lincoln actually did refuse to obey a Supreme Court order. I think he's the only president who ever has ultimately done that, despite threats. Even Franklin Roosevelt and Teddy Roosevelt made similar arguments. And as you say, as you suggest, coming out of the Trump administration these days about, quote-unquote, so-called judges, right, or judges being disgraceful in their opposition to his travel ban, or Trump aides saying that judges were not allowed to question the president's power in immigration law, which I think they're similar. You know, with Trump today, I don't know if the cases are the same. I do see or I worry about this intention behind the executive order, if it's really there, to take, you know, to almost retaliate against certain immigrants because of their religion. That does worry me. I don't think it has the same, I think, more noble purpose that Jackson had about keeping the union together.
You examine similarities with President Nixon.
Presidential power fluctuates and expands based on the circumstances, you know, and the war, emergencies, crises, but that, you know, during periods of stability without external threat, and presidency's powers ought to recede. A lot of the bad presidents actually, interestingly, follow pretty closely after some of our greatest ones. And I try to figure out, why have these presidents been failures? And, you know, we tend to focus a lot on their personalities. And so, but to me, one of the failures, and Nixon, I think, really exemplified this, is that they don't understand the circumstances they're in. And for example, they might be in a period crisis and they don't step forward, like I would say James Madison or James Buchanan, or like Nixon, they are no longer in a period of crisis and emergency, but they try to invoke the broader powers of the presidency out of step with the times. And so Nixon made these claims about, right, the president can do no wrong, the president can do whatever he wants, and so on. But I think those were mistaken because there was no emergency and crisis to which he was responding to, and he was aiming those tools, which are really for the defense of the country, and he was aiming them at the inside. He's aiming them domestically. Actually, the immigration order is more like Nixon, in that Trump is, you know, invoking or claiming a national security emergency, essentially, mm-hmm. with immigration coming in the country, and yeah. then claiming a right under the statutes, but also to keep from the courts any explanation of why he's issued this order. And there's no emergency. I think that's the thing. There's no emergency about immigration. Immigration has always been under constitutional authority of Congress. This is a Supreme Court case going back almost 150 years now that held that.
Yeah.
And see, that's an example. Like, you know, if we were in a war, I would think the president could block people. If we went to war, say, with Iran, I could see the president having authority to say, I'm going to block aliens from Iran from coming into the country right now. There are various statutes which allow him to do that. That would make sense. But we're not in a war with these seven countries.
Yeah.
You know, he's invoking these kind of commander-in-chief powers for things that are not. And Nixon did the same thing. Now, Trump has, you know, Trump is waging these kinds of fights right now. They're similar to Nixon in that, you know, as you say, Nixon often tussled with the intelligence agencies. Actually, it's more the problems that the intelligence agencies were doing what Nixon wanted. Mm. You know, Trump is having more of a fight with them. Mm. There's this sort of air secrecy around the administration is kind of similar to Trump. But I think the overall similarity to me is not really constitutional. It's really political. You know, Trump is claiming he represents a sort of forgotten majority in the country. And so it
yes.
kind of it gives him leverage, or he thinks it gives him some kind of leverage then to make claims about situations which then invoke great presidential power. And I think that's
yeah.
a fault of Nixon's, and it could be a critical flaw in the way Trump is approaching his constitutional, you know,
you know, Jackson didn't use the term forgotten majority, but one could draw a line back to him as well.
Oh, I totally agree with that. I think you're quite right to draw a parallel, you know, with the claim to represent a group of voters or group of population that's powerless.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I wasn't a big supporter of Trump's during the campaign. That sort of appeal worries me.
The discussion explores the power of Congress to restrain an executive.
Congress, I suppose both through its investigation and in particular through its impeachment power, is the ultimate check on the executive. But I worry that it's dangerous to rely on impeachment as the main bulwark, because there may be political moments like this one when Congress is supine. Is that something that worries you? Do you have any second thoughts about how the branches balance one another?
Yeah, I mean, I do think, and this probably comes from my perspective of having been an aide in Congress, that I think Congress does have plenty of constitutional powers to restrain an executive if Congress has the political will to use it. And that's your really your question. It's not really a question of constitutional authorities to me. It's just whether Congress has the institutional will to use those powers. And they don't have to go as far as, even as far as impeachment. You know, if Congress wants to turn around President Trump's immigration order, it can do that in a simple one-sentence statute. In fact, I would think Congress should try that and see what happens. I mean, see if President Trump will actually sign it. Congress can stop the building of a wall. Congress can prevent, you know, the withdrawal from NAFTA. I think, the president has a lot of discretion, especially in foreign affairs. But I think the Congress, through the funding power and a lot of constitutional, can check a lot of that even before you have to talk about something as serious as impeachment. But also, I'm in favor of much broader use of impeachment, because if you go back and look at the framing and you look at what the framers, the writers of the Constitution and its ratifiers said about impeachment, it was thought initially believed to be something that would be more broadly used. And I think over time we've kind of narrowed it to this idea, you know, that we fought over in the Clinton years. You know, do you have to commit a crime as president, commit perjury in order to be impeached? I think the Congress was initially would have been allowed to remove presidents for being bad at president, for maladministration, or just because I think ultimately they had serious constitutional conflicts.
You finishes by making some observations about President Trump's first few weeks in power.
Well, I mean, it's incredible how much controversy has accompanied just the first 3 weeks of his administration. You know, it hasn't even been a month yet at the time we're speaking. And so I think part of that is he hasn't been doing a good job of navigation. He hasn't been doing a good job of cooperating with Congress. But I think he's still, you know, he's still hungover from the campaign, right? He campaigned on this idea that he was going to, drain the swamp, and he was going to be the bull in the china shop in Washington. And if you campaign on that, it's hard then to come into Washington and then, you know, working within the system. He certainly doesn't see his modus operandi to be, you know, working within the regular channels of power within Washington. But I think that's a mistake because, as we just said, I think a lot of it is still up to Congress, and he has to work with Congress to achieve a lot of his agenda. I mean, he can't cut taxes and get the economy growing by himself. That's really only something Congress can do. And that's what his reelection is going to hinge on.